And welcome to this edition of the Hagman. The Hagman Report. So proud to be a part of your life. Thanks for inviting us into your homes, into your office buildings, in one case, into your diner, where our show is heard 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
They still listen? Is that in Tennessee? Or
no, that's actually, ask me not to say. So,
okay.
But actually, well, welcome, diners. You know where you're listening from, but it's great to have you. And it's interesting that you get a TV and then you can watch us, too. How's that? We have a very special guest with us right now, of course. He's Daniel List. His website is darkjournalist.com. That's darkjournalist.com. If you're unfamiliar with that website, you got to check it out. He is on the cutting edge of some extremely, well, breaking stories. And he's got one exclusive to, this is his find, and he's going to tell us about it. But before we bring on Daniel, I just want to ask the guys out there, hey, are you ready for Valentine's Day? Or whatever that occasion might be. Are you tired of guessing what your wife, your mom wants for Valentine's Day? Wouldn't it be great just to be able to give your wife, your mother, your sister, whoever it might be, even your daughters, whoever, just beautiful flowers for Valentine's Day or just that special day? Well, let me direct you to proflowers.com. That's proflowers.com. On top of their already low prices, right now you can get 2 dozen assorted roses with a free glass vase for just $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can upgrade for an additional $9.99 more. You can get 2 dozen long stem assorted roses with a premium vase and chocolate. You can't beat that deal. Don't tell my wife, but one's on its way. Just go to proflowers.com and use our code HAGMAN. That's H-A-G-M-A-N-N. Help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Use our code HAGMAN. You know, you can pick your flowers and then check out in under 2 minutes. I've done it. And I did order some flowers for my wife, and I'll just tell you about this. I did get this offer. It is available for us. And I just had so much fun. It was easy. It was simple. And they're going to be here on Monday. Don't tell her on Monday. But nonetheless, you can set the delivery day you want. You can order now and have it delivered on Valentine's Day if you'd like, right to her home or to her place of business or work. When her coworkers gush over her gift, you'll know you did Valentine's Day right. You can't beat the price. You can't beat the convenience. ProFlowers takes care of the details. You get to sit back, relax, and just look awesome. And guys, I know you like that. One more time here. Here's the only way to get 2 dozen assorted roses with a free glass vase starting at $29.99. Just go to ProFlowers.com. Use our code HAGMAN. And again, folks, help support this show by supporting our sponsors. Use our code HAGMAN. That's proflowers.com. Click on the microphone and type in our code HAGMAN. Don't wait. Order today because this deal does expire soon. So it's with great pleasure that we have welcoming back to the program dark journalist Daniel Litz. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys.
It's great that you're here. And thanks for appearing on video. You look great. Now, you've got some breaking news, and I just can't wait to hear it. It's exclusive to you. What's going on?
Well, this is really fascinating. I've been tracking a story with a retired professor from the University of Calgary named Dr. Carmen Bolter, and we've been in touch since last spring on this, but the details are only now really coming to the surface. Now, I recently put out a video which is about this find, which is of ancient Egyptian artifacts in Turkey, which is very perplexing because you wonder, how is there this ancient Egyptian find in Turkey? What would make that happen? And as we got more and more into it, oddly enough, the story goes that this tracks back to the Akhenaten Nefertiti period, where there was a great upheaval in Egypt. And once in a while, you know, you'll hear about stories, fantastic things about this period, because it's kind of a mystery. Because what happened was the Amun priesthood, who was in charge of Egypt at the time, had to get rid of Akhenaten because he was going to monotheism, and the Egyptians were polytheistic and, you know, had all the different gods and all the different symbolism. And he started to move them in this direction of a one god with Aten, and that was very controversial. He did a number of controversial things, like, for example, he moved the capital, what would basically be like moving Washington, D.C. to Arizona, for example. So he moved the capital of Egypt to Amarna, and as a result, there's a big jumble there in history. Nobody quite knows exactly what happened, except that he's sort of taken out of the picture. There's a quick succession of five pharaohs who rule in very short spurts, and then you get King Tut, who was Akhenaten's son. So it's a very unusual thing, and Tut, of course, dies at the age of 19. So that whole string from Nefertiti through Akhenaten to Tut has always been archaeologically a mystery, but they kind of cover it up also. Because in mainstream archaeology, Akhenaten has to be viewed as kind of a heretic, you know. He's sort of, they give him this image of being somebody outside of the norm, and more he's portrayed as sort of this fanatic. When in fact it looks like he was just kind of bucking the political stream that was going on at the time. So with that as a backdrop, now Tut is the biggest find in Egypt from 1922, with Howard Carter finding the tomb and searched for it for years. And there we had the most complete tomb to really give us an idea of, in the 20th century, what was going on in ancient Egypt. So it was probably the biggest find since the Rosetta Stone. But there's been a pretty big kind of gulf of time, almost 100 years here, where there hasn't been many new developments around this story. And so finally, this group of Turkish investigators found this very unusual discovery, and they were working closely with Dr. Bolter. And Dr. Bolter got in touch with me about it and started sending me these very unusual images from the dig. And the images really have the power to change history, because we're seeing a very complete Egyptian tomb in Turkey, and some of the preliminary dating test results are also showing us that the dating may go back much further than the typical 1300 BC set for that period. The dating that they're finding is 10,000 BC. So we're looking at a little bit of an archaeological earthquake. The complication is the dig is in a military zone, and there is the potential that the military may get it. So this is kind of, as we say, late-breaking news. Well, this is about as late-breaking as you get.
My goodness. Now, just to be clear, Akhenaten is the guy that is the, he looks like, well, Obama looks like Akhenaten, in a sense. He's been compared to that figure. But just,
they did. Yeah. They have done those, yeah. And, of course, I mean, you know, yeah. You can say that really anyone could look like that. What's actually striking about Akhenaten and Nefertiti is the complete lack of any kind of African makeup, any kind of African characteristics, oddly enough. And, you know, this is another strange thing about them when they show up. They almost seem like a group of Europeans who just wandered into the picture and left. So, you know, we do have that with Akhenaten and Nefertiti. They stand out in this way, and that they're not in the regular lineage of the Egyptians.
All right. That's interesting. Well, I've done some research on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just have the Akhenaten. I keep remembering the, I believe it was an artist or a mural of some kind that they have, like this alien baby or something. That's Akhenaten, right? Is that what you're talking about?
I have no doubt that they portray him with an alien baby. Somehow it doesn't surprise me, because it does, the very kind of mystery around those two gives it this air of mystery, so that we're always looking for unusual things. But there is something kind of otherworldly about that period, and his appearance, and Nefertiti is almost, you know, her appearance is almost like, you know, very inhuman, in that it's very kind of beautiful. You know, so it's luminescent, and we have this kind of mythological pair there. One of the things about the dig that I found fascinating, since it is in Turkey, it represents the idea that probably Nefertiti fled Egypt and went to Turkey, because when the Yamun priesthood decided it was time for Akhenaten to go, she probably figured it out, and she didn't stick around. So she took a lot of these artifacts from Amarna. Now, what I find really interesting about it is this. The dating on the sarcophagus in Turkey. It goes back 10,000 BC, which is 12,000 years ago.
How can that even be? That versus history, but go on. I guess that was kind of just a...
No, you're making a really good point. And this is the strange thing about it. If the entire dig proves out, as far as the dating is concerned, then it may prove that these two individuals are part of a legacy rather than being just two people at one particular frozen moment in time. This is a legacy of a group. That is, Akhenaten and Nefertiti were handed down, you know, over time in succession, in generations, and that they came to rule Egypt as part of this lineage. But that would make them a very old group, and it wouldn't make them one particular snapshot of a person in history. It would make them representatives of, very much like, you know, sort of like Queen Elizabeth is the representative of this line. But it is interesting because we have a lot of anomalies with it. One, that it's in Turkey, and two, it's in a military zone, which complicates things a lot for the researchers. And three, the fact that we have this really heavy-duty dating. And if anyone but Dr. Bolter came to me with this information, I wouldn't have known what to make of it. But she, you know, she did the Pyramid Code, which is the five-part documentary series on Netflix, which is outstanding. And she pulled together all these facts about the pyramid that nobody knew. And she lived in Egypt. She's led over 30 tours there. She's kind of, you know, she knew the original wisdom keeper who kept the grounds around Giza, and she worked with him. So, you know, she really, as far as somebody having a real inside track, she's about as good as you're going to get. When she came forward with the images, which are available at darkjournalist.com, and I did send you guys a couple to look
at. Yes, and in deference to you, folks, I do want you to go to darkjournalist.com. I mean, this is his exclusive story. We will, of course, associate the images into this program, but this is your story. This is your exclusive history changing, forever history changing story. So, with, you know, out of deference to you, that I really want to direct people to your website, darkjournalist.com, but go ahead.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's interesting with this study. I mean, I've always had a very interesting kind of focus around Egypt, because you might recall that only in the past 20 years, geologists got together and decided that the Sphinx was much older based on the weather pattern. And what we got was big pushback from Egyptologists saying, no, you know, it's not true, it can't be happening. You know, show me the culture that was in between this 2500 BC and your 10,000 BC. It can't be there. And it was very odd because, you know, geologists are very hardcore scientists. They really don't have a dog in the fight of ancient history, but they know geological patterns of weathering, water weathering, and things like that. So Robert Schock, who is up here out of Boston University, he came out and tested it and said, well, you know what? The weathering comes from rain. So,
okay.
When was the last time we had rain in Giza? And you have to go back to 10,000 BC for that type of weather patterning for rain. So, there's no doubt that the dating is wrong in Egypt, that the culture, there was an older culture there at a certain point, but the Egyptian authorities, typical media, and the regular kind of rules around archaeology don't permit us to go there, because they've set this whole thing up with Egyptology, but Egyptology has only been around since the 18th century. And frankly, they're not using any of the modern tools to set up their history. We have way more modern techniques. We have satellites, ground penetrating radar, and all types of different ways to do this. And so to simply take the word of something that was done in the 17th, 18th century doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, interestingly enough, Egyptologists and archaeology in general is very skeptical about really hardcore facts. You know, they regard, for example, Solomon's temple as a myth. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Huh.
So they're very protective around their territory. They want to relate it back to their version of history. And if it's not in their version, you're out. And so there's a whole chain there where if you don't get funding and you're a scientist, if you're an archaeologist, you're certainly, you're kind of out of luck, because what are you going to do, one person against the world, even if you find something? So this is what's interesting about Dr. Carmen Bolter's story, which is she's such an authority that it's kind of going to be very hard to ignore her findings. And when she got in touch with me about them, my own reaction was to say, you know, this is big, like, are you ready? You know, because
yeah,
it's not an easy ride.
What are the implications here? Okay, so we have, and folks, go to darkjournalist.com and click on the story, Akhenaten Discovery. There, the part one interview with Dr. Carmen Bolter. But what are the implications of this, the larger implications, as we stand here in 2017, looking back over the landscape of history? What does this do to history? Or what does this imply, I suppose?
Well, that's a great question. And that's exactly where we have to go when we get something that upsets the apple cart of the dating system, is like, what actually has been going on, and why is that such a different story from what we've been told? Why is it so hard to get a straight answer on these things? You know, it reminds me, I was doing an interview with Russell Targ, who you probably know, out of SRI, who did a lot of remote viewing, and he's a physicist who just, the CIA hired him to basically do psychic spying, to run the psychic spying program that he developed. And one of the things we got into conversation about was how the CIA had a program to find Noah's Ark. It's a very unusual.
Is that in their mandate? I'm just curious.
You know, and definitely not. But what's interesting about that to me, and it has been declassified, so it's been borne out what he was telling me. But he was also telling me about their deep, deep interest in mysticism, psychic phenomena, all of these subjects. That on the surface, while a lot of these official institutions will ridicule these things, they tend to have a great interest to put a lot of resources behind the scenes around it. And that they funded him 20 years doing this program. So they obviously had a huge interest in it. And in fact, it was declassified by accident.
By accident.
Yeah. And, you know, it is interesting because, of course, at that time, the Russians had a program where they were developing a kind of psychic defense group in their military. And so that made our guys interested. But I thought it was interesting around archaeology, because the CIA being interested in archaeology, what does that tell us? That there's something to the story of humanity that interests them, and their main interest is power, of course. So what is it that's back there? What does it represent? And why is it part of their kind of hidden agenda? And this is kind of fascinating, but if you go even deeper than that, you'll find that there are programs where, for example, I did an episode recently with Dr. Joseph Farrell on something called Archaeology Wars, where countries will take advantage of certain situations, like the Iraq War, mm-hmm. to go in and vandalize artifacts to try to put these puzzle pieces together. But he goes a step further, suggesting that one of the big reasons behind the Iraq War was to get these certain artifacts.
I've heard that.
In the Baghdad Museum. Now, what could be in the Baghdad Museum, you wonder, that our intelligence agencies and our military would be that interested in? And then, if you go deeper than that, are we talking about the American military? Because, of course, the teams that were looking in Baghdad at the time, that were doing archaeological digs for Saddam, were German. So he had a very tight relationship with German archaeologists who were doing all these digs for him. So there's also been the suggestion that all the looting at the museum, there are a lot of eyewitness accounts that the looting was done by American soldiers. And there's a guy, actually, who is a high-ranking officer in the military who did a book on this. And instead of, you know, chasing down a few Iraqis to find the artifacts, he had to travel three continents to find where this stuff went. And his conclusion was that it wasn't Americans going in there at all. That was somebody actually putting on American uniforms to create a diversion to grab these artifacts. Now, there is a story around that period of history in Sumeria about these Atlantean firestones, which are kind of a ancient technology. And they had the ability to basically immobilize an invading army and that kind of thing. And they created a lot of fantastic legends out of this. But it has been suggested that some of this emphasis around the Middle East involves these ancient artifacts, because there's a story called the Epic of Ninurta, which catalogs these weapons being put away after a kind of cosmic war takes place in the past. And, you know, as we get into these myths, we start to see that this is a typical theme. There's some kind of, you know, if it's war in the heavens or is it an actual war? Even if you go to Vedic texts, they're experiencing these wars, and it basically sounds like, you know, some kind of nuclear exchange. So we're looking at maybe a more evolved, advanced culture back there having a lot of difficulty. And the weapons that they possessed were simply hidden. So, you know, in a more modern kind of era, the Nazis had a very aggressive program for going after these types of archaeological finds. And, you know, they believed they were looking for the Grail or whatever it happened to be. But the point is that what they realize is there's a kind of advantage in having the real idea of the past and the actual technology of the past.
Okay. Where to start at this point? Wow. You had mentioned something here. There's a couple of things.
If I can jump in.
Please do.
You know, you're talking about the, and I've heard many of these stories. I have friends who were in Iraq who have uniforms I claim are Saddam Hussein's or whatever. I haven't heard about the uniforms being worn by other nations in order to throw
the
people
Americans
off.
To go into the antiquity, you know.
But
yeah.
What I wanted to ask was about these artifacts. I don't know how much detail you have on the actual artifacts, but do you believe that if there was something of such great interest and value, that they would even have it on display at the museum, or is this something that, or
that's the source, the source location, that is, or would this be fair to the way, like, in like a vault type thing?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. You'd think, would it be out there and displayed? I think the point is, really, if you're talking about the central location of the museum, maybe they just knew it was inside there. It probably is a good location to store these types of things. You're probably displaying things on one level, but you probably have a whole hidden system where you can kind of store your valuables. And the thing about the Baghdad Museum is we know that certain things have come out of there, like the Baghdad Battery, which showed a very early electromagnetic plating that they did at the time. Now, they claimed, like they do with any big find from prehistory, that, oh, well, you know, this was for jewelry, and, you know, so what if they figured out electricity? They didn't do anything with it. But as you go deeper into it, you know, I was talking about Dr. Bolter there. One of the things that she did in the Pyramid Code is she introduced the work of someone who was studying what he called electric ancient Egyptians. And this is very interesting. It's James Ernest Brown, and he basically can track widespread use of electricity throughout Egypt, but only among these royal scenes. It wasn't something that you would see the regular people in the street had. But the royal people and the priests had a great understanding of electricity, and the question becomes, where did they get it? And part of these finds and part of this idea about Atlantis, for example, which comes down to us from Plato, which is a very authoritative source, gives us the idea that there's a very advanced culture that was operating there. Now, the story gets very kind of thick and dense because in Egypt, there was a real iron grip on all the artifacts over the past 20 to 30 years by Zahi Hawass, who really controlled the Giza Plateau where the Sphinx and the pyramids are. And as a result of his kind of iron hand there, a lot of these discoveries, like we were talking about with geology and redating the Sphinx, got slowed down dramatically. And really, you know, it gets hard on the ground. You know, it might sound to us great out here in the public. They've made these incredible finds. But when your people like Dr. Bolter or Robert Schock the geologists who did the dating, if you don't get permits to dig, you know, they can really control what you do, and they can slow that stuff down, and they really have. I'd say a lot of these finds around the Sphinx were taking place in 1995. Yeah. I remember Charlton Heston doing a special on NBC about it. You know, this is, I grew up with that, right? And here we are 20 years later. What happened to it?
It's
so
interesting. Zahi Awas, a good friend of Art Bell back in the, and folks, you might remember this, Art Bell, Coast to Coast, or Dreamland, Coast to Coast AM, back in the 90s. Zahi Awas coming on and speaking hours with Art Bell about the antiquities being found. And by the way, Daniel, and for the people listening, the 03 war, or back in 2003 when the U.S. went into Iraq, at least 13,864 objects were taken, stolen from the Baghdad Museum. Supposedly 500,000 or half a million objects in the museum. Thieves had about 36 hours to finger through them and to thumb through them. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, we were talking with Daniel Litz of the Dark Journalist, darkjournalist.com. We'll be right back with us. He's going to be with us in through the next segment. Again, folks, bookmark darkjournalist.com and check out some of the incredible content, both audio and news content there. They have audio files. They have guests. It's a great place to go to get information. We'll be right back with Daniel after these short messages. Stay with us.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and the Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
New Year from all of us at Trading Post in the Woods.
We pray you have a healthy, safe, and prosperous 2017.
And we would like to thank all of you for welcoming us to the Hagman and Hagman family. You're all a very wonderful and special group of people.
Because we believe it is so important for you to work and acquire good health this year, we're going to do something that we've never done before as a thank you to you for your support. We're going to make something available that we believe everyone needs.
During the month of January, anyone who invests in their health by purchasing either our American Heritage Remedies Kit, our Survivalist Natural Remedies Kit, or $200 in individual remedies of your choice, we're going to give to you our crisis remedy, just in case, for free.
Your health must be a part of your preparation plan. We're here to help you with that journey. May God bless y'all, and may God bless America.
Happy New Year!
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
Hagman and the Hagman Report. Our very special guest, Mr. Daniel List from, well, he's the Dark Journalist. I like his outfit. I like his suit. Outfit, what am I saying? I like a suit. Black tie affair. He's the Dark Journalist. Go to darkjournalist.com and check out his latest exclusive story. This is groundbreaking stuff.
And there's a lot of subjects on his website. I was looking at this today. The things we talk about on the show.
Absolutely.
Pretty regularly from, you know, stuff like Steve Quayle and L.A. Marzulli, what they talked about yesterday.
This ties all together.
The one I haven't looked at yet that I want to get into is The Secret World of Deep Underground Bases.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about that. But before we get back to our guest, let me ask you a question. If you're up in the frozen tundra of the north, you haven't seen the sun or grass for, you know, I don't know, 3-4 months. Would you like to get away? I certainly would. We found this amazing getaway package. It's at an even more amazing price. The Pineapple Beach Club in Antigua. Right now, for just $149 per person, plus a $250 resort credit, you can enjoy an adults-only, and by that I mean 16 and up, all-inclusive getaway on a white sandy beach. Oh, just think about it right now. Smell the salt sea air. Go to pineapplebeachclub.com and make your reservation today. Now, let me tell you just very quick a little bit more about the resort and the island. The package is all inclusive, by the way. It includes your meals and snacks and beverages. Yes, even the alcohol, a glass of wine with dinner, whatever. Water sports, daily entertainment. It includes all taxes and gratuity, so there are no hidden fees. The resort encompasses 30 acres of just beautiful tropical foliage and panoramic vistas. Oh, just imagine that. Close your eyes for a minute unless you're driving. And think about that. Oh, seeing the water and the palm fronds, just, oh my goodness, and smelling that beach air. The resort also has 2 freshwater pools, a spa, 5 restaurants, and you know, the credit can be used for sailing trips and romantic dining. Oh, take your better half out for dinner, okay? The gift shop, a safari tour, spa services. So when you're ready, and you need to be ready to leave the frosty weather behind and get some well-deserved R&R, don't wait. This offer expires soon. Go to pineapplebeachclub.com. Or if you have a pen right now, write this number down. 800-772-8711. That's 800-772-8711. Or simply go to pineapplebeachclub.com to book your all-inclusive stay. For $149 per night per person, you can enjoy everything I mentioned and even more. Plus, you'll get $250 resort credit. That's pineapplebeachclub.com. Folks, see the website for all details. Again, pineapplebeachclub.com. But we're talking with Mr. Daniel Litz from the his
dark
website.
Darkjournalist.com.
I keep wanting to put the in front of everything. Darkjournalist.com. So, but you were just, what an amazing story about this find. And you said, oh, there's more during the break. Oh, there's more. So continue.
The story gets pretty deep, and it's great to be on here with you guys too. I listen to the show a lot, and I'm always getting great ideas. It's funny you mentioned Marzulli, because I did listen to that, and I was thinking when he was talking about giants and his research about a story that Dr. Bolter told me when I met her, which is that when she was doing routine archaeology in Egypt back in the 90s, she ran across these kind of guards who, they guard the temples and they guard the artifacts and stuff. And they were saying to her, you know, do you want to see something really interesting? You know, but it's off limits. And so she made this arrangement to see it with them. And they showed her this 15-foot sarcophagus. There wasn't a mummy in it, but in that tomb, they had made this 15-foot sarcophagus, which is a very unusual thing to do. The average Egyptian is about 6 feet. Wow. So, you know, there's definitely an overlap between mythology and real history in these stories. And, you know, as we kind of like are emerging with our own scientific paradigm and reexamining the ancient world, we shouldn't be afraid to go there and look and see, well, you know, these myths and legends were actually true. It's happened over and over again that, you know, we've seen it in archaeology, things that were mythological at one point became factual as soon as the kind of real archaeology was put into play. So this thing about giants, I think, is very interesting.
I just want to say this, and then I'm going to turn it to you, Joe. It's interesting to me as a Christian man who really never, honestly, never really understood the Bible or thought the Bible way back when. Now, don't send me emails, okay? I just didn't get excited about the information in the Bible. Now it's like, okay, you talk about giants, you talk about these men of renown. My goodness, this is real. And now you're coming over here and you're saying, look, this is what we just discovered. I just bringing to light, and it's tying into everything. And Joe, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you about the, since we're talking about archaeology and the giants and history, we've heard a lot about the Smithsonian Museum covering up, findings of giants and from archaeological digs and other, research missions that went on. Is there any other organizations, or have you come across anything like this where you see evidence historically of giants or that would verify the Bible being hidden or covered up by institutions or people?
Well, I have no doubt that there's a very controlled narrative. For example, I mean, the way I would liken it is, you know, when I've worked in traditional media outlets, and the type of environment there was when a story would come up, you could take it so far, you know. So this might relate to something else that was coming up at the time, but there was an environment there that you got to this choke point around information. So, for example, before the housing crisis hit and the financial meltdown, there were certain things you could not say leading up to it. And so I've always had a sense for when those things were coming up. When it comes to archaeology, you know, just like NASA with space, something like the Smithsonian, we're not going to get the full story on because, for one, they are ingratiated to things like the Rockefeller Foundation. The Rockefeller Foundation has a great interest in archaeology. They have a great interest in funding archaeological digs, and they have a great interest in holding all that information to themselves. You know, another great example is MUFON, which studies UFO contacts and UFO sightings and UFO technology. Well, there's a guy named Bigelow who runs Bigelow Aerospace out of Nevada, and Bigelow is a very interesting character, very interested in all different types of activities around UFOs. So he did incredible funding for UFOs, but one of the things that he made mandatory was that MUFON couldn't show certain types of findings to the public anymore. And because MUFON was this small UFO organization with practically no budget, you know, and this guy is coming around with $1 million budget, sure, why not? You know, he gets all the data. This is the way it works. You know, they certainly like this type of information. The Rockefeller Foundation funded Zechariah Sitchin's research, for example. And, you know, Sitchin, everyone and their grandmother has taken off with the Anunnaki themes that he developed. Mm-hmm. But certainly he did some good research initially around the period, and they sort of vacuumed up a lot of that. So these institutions which claim to be, you know, holding straight and narrow science and, you know, here's your regular archaeology, it goes like a straight line just like this, they're the ones who kind of, not only do they not let it out to the public, but they actively dissuade the public from getting involved in these types of things. And I've seen it over and over again. Strangely enough, though, it works the same way the political media structure works. If they found something, you know, you were talking about biblical scholarship. When people look at the Bible archaeologically, there's all kinds of evidence for the different stories. But in traditional archaeology, Sodom and Gomorrah is the mythological story. So we see the difference there. If somebody's looking for the facts on the ground, you can find, you know, all kinds of examples of these stories, you know, for the story of Moses and so on. So certainly, science and archaeology have a problem with portraying history as it was. Now, interestingly enough, in what we were talking about with Dr. Carmen Bolter's find, and some of the stories that have come out of Egypt, like the Sphinx redating, for example, to a much older period, because the Sphinx currently dated around 2500 BC. The dating took it to 10,500 BC. That's 8,000 years. So that kind of a gulf really creates problems. If you've created this whole system, you know, it, basically the system that you've crafted won't do. And what are people going to find out if they start getting into that? This seems to be not only a lock around information, but a kind of a lock around consciousness in a sense. Because if I become conscious of that period, I'm going to lock into it somehow and become aware of things far beyond the way it's taught. It's history, which is basically, you know, the Hittites and the Phoenicians and the Egyptians all fought, and, you know, the Hebrews were taken as slaves. And this whole, this is one chapter of the whole thing when we have a much larger picture going on here, I think.
So if, what's the,
yeah, go ahead.
What's the motive? I mean, what would be, I rather than me trying to assume, you tell me what you believe would be the motive in this. Because, I mean, I can see the obvious overt implications to history. But when you take a look at this from, you know, take a step back and take a look at all of this, what's the motive here to cover this up or to keep this quiet? Or to ask it another way, the discovery that you're disclosing has serious implications. In what way?
Oh, it's an excellent question, actually. Well, the reason I call it Archaeology Wars is because we have to think of it in terms of what somebody gets, you know, the type of kind of positioning that nations do to get information on other nations, to get an advantage over other nations, and what they can do with it. So there are certainly deep forces attached to this. You know, if, like Russell Targ was saying, the CIA was looking for Noah's Ark, what does that tell you? That intelligence has a wing, just like the Nazis had a wing, that looks into ancient history as a means to produce an advantage for the current culture. So one of the things that I'll do it through two individuals, Zahi Hawass, who we mentioned, and Mark Lehner. Now, Mark Lehner and Hawass had a lock over the Giza Plateau until Mubarak was thrown out of office. Mubarak, before he was thrown out of office, and he was the president for over 20 years in Egypt, he was overthrown by a military coup during the whole rise-up during the Arab Spring. But he had elevated Hawass to cabinet level as the Minister of Culture and Antiquities. So if we think about the power of that, you know, a cabinet-level officer is somebody, as you get down the line, who could actually take over the country. So why would you have an archaeologist as a cabinet member? It's a very unusual move. Another strange thing about Hawass is that every time the guy turned around or sneezed, there was a new National Geographic special with him at the helm, and he was coming out with all these wild things. Well, I have the DNA of Nefertiti, and, you know, I found this, I found that. None of it panned out to be true. If you go back and all through these different things that they had specials about, all of the information that came apart. So what was it that was behind that whole push, and how do you get someone that institutionalized to just feed the line? Well, let's study Hawass and Lehner for a minute. Lehner was a high school dropout who was the boyfriend of the son of Edgar Cayce, who was the famous sleeping psychic in Virginia Beach. And Cayce ran Cayce's readings. When he did his psychic readings, he did a lot of health readings, but he did a lot of readings about ancient history, and he made a number of very interesting predictions, and a lot of things he said about the past turned out to be true. So I think that in terms of Cayce's work, there's a lot of value to it. But his son, who was running the ARE, Hugh Lynn, wanted very much to create a structure where they could go into these countries and actually find out if the Cayce readings were correct. So he actually built up this guy out of the blue, who really was directionless, and sent him to college and sent him through archaeology training and placed him in Cairo. And Lehner became the top person for archaeology with Hawass, and they both ran the Giza Plateau. Now, Hawass also has a huge tie into Cayce's organization, the ARE. And I understand, by the way, I'm not trying to suggest anything that about the ARE being, you know, in any way kind of behind-the-scenes conspiratorial. I think what they're trying to do is prove some of Casey's predictions about the Atlanteans and the Hall of Records and the things that he's looking for. But Hawass and Lehner were both funded and put into position in Cairo by the ARE. So they know all about Casey's information about Atlantis, the prehistory of Egypt, the Hall of Records that's supposed to be under the Sphinx, all of this stuff. They know it hardcore because their sponsor was the ARE, which is Casey's foundation. So this is a very unusual set of circumstances. We have to understand that their public face, where they just hold the line and say, well, you know, Egyptians, they came up and, you know, they built the pyramid by passing mud bricks and that kind of thing. You know, this whole charade that they are putting on is really, you know, something for the public. And they know the deeper esoteric information, and they're obviously students of it. And I find it very unusual that they were in those types of positions at the very top of that archaeological pyramid, but they had this very deep esoteric tone. I think it tells you a lot about how important control of those artifacts and those plateaus and those monuments are. I think it could tell us a great deal about the past that we don't know.
Yeah, and I agree. And it's a shame that we have, you know, people hiding and keeping from the public a lot of the discoveries that are made, but that's been the way it has been throughout history, and I'm sure it will continue. We'll continue that on that same track. We have about, 10 minutes left of the interview.
Yeah, we do.
Daniel, I don't know, you want to continue to talk about
it's an amazing discovery,
the Egyptian investigation, or do you want to take it somewhere else with the few minutes we have left?
Well, that's great. Well, it's great to be here with you guys, really.
It's great to have you. I mean, you do such great work, and if I can just sing your praises for a moment. Folks, go to darkjournalist.com, all right? Do that. Bookmark that website. You know, I really like good investigators, great investigators, actually. And there you have, at darkjournalist.com, one great investigator.
And endangered species today.
Exactly. The newsletter he's got, the audio files. And you know his tagline, the truth is never easy. Very well stated in some cutting edge conversations with people like Jim Mars and Joseph Farrell and his special reports. Folks, it's a wealth of information, darkjournalist.com. But, okay, I want to ask you one thing, because we kind of glossed over this. The location from Egypt to Turkey, that's troublesome beyond just a passing statement. How does that work?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Well, we haven't had a major find in a different country of, you know, Egyptian artifacts. Not on the record, anyway. Certainly, there's a very unusual story that came out about Grand Canyon artifacts looking very Mayan and very Egyptian. But that story was covered up because of the era that it was in around the 1920s. But this find represents a real change in the paradigm of how we look at ancient history. So we have to imagine for a moment that whoever took these artifacts in the first place was fleeing from Amarna, which was Akhenaten's destination, the new capital. And so if there was upheaval there, they took off with a number of these kind of representations. Now, we think it's Nefertiti who took off with these goods and placed them hurriedly in a tomb in Turkey. Now, I think what this is telling us, though, is that we're looking at this story and trying to get to the bottom of it. You know, if we find these artifacts to be 10,000 years old, as the dating suggests, then the idea is that they're heirlooms, that they've had them over time, which gives us that age of ancient Egypt again. So it is really a breakthrough, not only in dating in traditional archaeology, and I'm sure they're going to find a number of reasons to try to say the dating is wrong. But as we know, in Turkey recently, they found a site called Göbekli Tepe, with these long towers, very unusual looking figurines, and huge circles that looked a lot like Stonehenge, for example. So, you know, when we're going into this, we're looking at that, they dated that site officially. Even National Geographic will tell you that the site dates to 12,000 years ago. Doesn't have anything to do with Egypt. It's some strange Turkish culture popped out of the blue, very advanced, building megaliths. Just, you know, 10,000 years earlier than everybody else. So we have a lot of problems on the dating front as far as archaeology is concerned. They're going to have to, I'd say, you know, nowadays, for example, there are findings coming out about pyramids in Spain.
Yes.
So that's, they're getting all that information from satellites. The geosatellites are changing everything about what we know about the ancient past. So we need to step it up from where it was. You know, this whole battle of redating the Sphinx that I got into is absurd. You know, that was in the 90s that that came up. We should know all that information. There should be a whole new view of history now. But there are these blocks and these choke points, as we've discussed. The core reason, I think, is that there's too much vested in one version of history, and they're not willing to let that version go. Also, if we were more advanced in the past, if there was an advanced culture back there, you know, advanced spiritually, advanced technologically, and it was taken out by a lower culture, then, you know, we could be looking at a whole different, like a huge influence on modern culture, which might threaten a lot of these kind of intelligence agencies and the types of grips that they have on things. I find it interesting, and I guess I'll wrap up with, I was talking about Russell Targ earlier, but it was a fascinating conversation because I've studied his work for so long, and he's in his 80s now, but sharp. And one of the things he told me was, you know, look, behind the scenes, they have extensive programs that are nested. And, you know, some of them go so dark that we'll never get any results in the public about it. But the programs that he was using, where they were trying to remote view objects, they went so far as to remote view the kidnapping of a U.S. diplomat, and they used the remote viewer to free him. So this is how deep this type of information goes. So when you think about that, then you realize, oh, there's all sorts of things that they're not telling us. And they have funding for that, and very often black budget funding, so it can't be traced. So when it comes to archaeology and archaeology wars, something like the Baghdad Museum, well, it's not very hard for deep elements in that intelligence community to create the impression that some soldiers went in there and grabbed artifacts. You know, be a very simple thing for them to do.
Very interesting.
And what you just talked about, some of the stuff came out in that big CIA document dump that they had about different CIA projects that back in the 70s and 60s, 70s that worked with, you know, telekinesis, that worked with the remote viewing, you know, researching and funding those kinds of projects in order to, according to the documents from what I've seen, they really didn't go anywhere. And there were some other documents that had kind of trumped up results with the somebody drawing something on a paper and a guy sitting across the room trying to draw the same things, you know, based on whatever you call it, being able to read other people's minds. And I never put much stock into remote viewing. But it is very interesting to see. Now, let me ask you, is there the ability to cover up a lot of this stuff that's discovered to steer the narrative in a certain direction? Is that due to people's lack of interest for archaeological digs? Or is this just something, as you said, that's controlled pretty much at the ground level there, making sure it never gets out?
I think it's more about controlling it at the ground level because people have a tremendous interest in archaeology, I've found. You do find that, you know, it's difficult. Where do you fit in when you're under siege by GMOs and chemtrails and political news and the crackdown, you know? And when you see these forces trying to create almost a civil war in America right now, you know, it's funny. I think it is hard to include some of these larger pictures, but I find that people make a place for it when it stands out. And something like this, for example, it's almost like people understand that the culture was a lot older, that there was something special back there, and that there was some kind of a cosmic war that took place in prehistory. There's too many legends about it. You know, there's a lot of things about before the flood in this antediluvian period that I think are very much worth looking into, and probably when we get a handle on that, we'll understand our position, you know, coming up through the centuries now, it's not like we've, you know, advanced so far beyond the ancient times. It's that we've come back up to civilization, which got wiped out back there at some point. And I think that's kind of worthwhile, yeah.
And the Bible says there's nothing new under the sun, and what was before will be again. And I have no doubt that there, I mean, just from the book of Enoch, talks about all the different technologies and forbidden secrets that were given to man, you know, by these entities and these fallen ones. So it's a very real possibility that we haven't even reached the point where a civilization from thousands of years ago was technologically then versus today. It's a very real possibility.
And I just want to direct people to darkjournalist.com. That's darkjournalist.com. Part one, interview with Dr. Carmen Bolter, Akhenaten Discovery, changes history forever. You've got to check that out. And we're so pleased and, grateful that, Daniel had, agreed to share his findings, their findings.
And thank you for
in this program.
Thank you for joining us, Daniel. We're at the end of our segment here. We'll have to have you back in the near future.
Man, yeah.
It's great to be with you guys.
It's great to have you. God bless you, my friend.
Keep
stay safe
work.
Out there. Yeah. Keep trucking.
All right. Talk soon.
All right.
After the break, we will be back with Pastor David Langford for our third and final hour on this Wednesday edition of the Hagman Report. Don't go anywhere.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in this community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.